cruise industry woes, Goodwill needs help, and starting a garden during a pandemic. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Congress is investigating one cruise company. Meanwhile, the CDC wants all cruise lines to do more to protect their workers. We'll get the latest news on the cruise industry from the Miami Herald's Taylor Dolvin. Also, the nonprofit Goodwill had to close its stores when the pandemic started. The company had to furlough thousands, and now they need help from the community. Plus, a century ago, Americans were asked to start gardens to help the war effort. So why are people starting gardens now, during a pandemic? Finally,
you're the only coach in all of professional sports who's associated with the word perfection.
I like that association.
We say farewell to former Dolphins coach Don Shula. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Hundreds of crew members on cruise ships still remain out at sea. They've been stuck in limbo for the past month and a half as CEOs of the major cruise companies have refused to agree to the CDC guidelines for disembarking. Over the weekend, Royal Caribbean became the first to agree to the CDC guidelines. Meanwhile, Congress launched an investigation on Friday into the actions by Carnival Cruise Lines over the past 5 months. Members of the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure are asking for all internal documents and communication related to COVID-19. Well, the Miami Herald's Taylor Dolvin joins us now to discuss these stories. Taylor, always great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the CDC guidelines. What are the CDC guidelines for cruise ships when it comes to disembarking their crew members?
Yeah, it's important to note that these guidelines changed after mid-April when the CDC extended its no-sail order for cruise lines, banning any cruise operation through July 24th. But the current guidelines say that crew members who are getting off ships have to be medically screened by the companies. The companies have to provide them with a mask for transportation. They're not allowed to stay overnight in a hotel. They have to travel on private transportation, either car or flight, and they can't interact with the public in any way on their journey home, among other things. So that's how things are now.
Does it matter whether or not there were cases of coronavirus on the cruise ships, or does this just apply to all ships that are currently out at sea?
My understanding is this is for all ships. People who are crew that are disembarking have to be asymptomatic and pass a medical screening to get off. And they also, crew who have been exposed to the virus cannot be traveling with crew who haven't. So companies also have to make that separation.
Why have the CEOs of these companies been hesitant to sign off on these guidelines?
So the CDC is requiring executives, the CEO, the chief medical officer, and the chief compliance officer from the companies to agree to these guidelines and also attest to the basically hold themselves accountable if they're not followed. And that comes with civil and criminal penalties. And so executives have been hesitant to open themselves up to that kind of penalty if these guidelines aren't followed. But we saw, as you mentioned, Royal Caribbean reverse its stance over the weekend and say that it will start signing these to allow people to get off. And it's important to note, all cruise companies have signed these agreements for some crew, a very limited amount over the last month.
So we have hundreds of crew members that remain on board ships, some off the coast of Florida. You spoke with Julia Whitcomb, who's currently on board the Celebrity Infinity cruise ship. What is her story? What's her experience been like?
Yeah, so it's actually thousands of crew members that are stuck, and cruise ships without passengers only require about 100 people to keep them in operation. And so any other crew are looking to get off. Most of them are looking to go home. Julia is a 24-year-old from Illinois. She's on the Celebrity Infinity ship owned by Royal Caribbean. It's currently anchored near the Bahamas, and she has been trying to get home since the industry shut down on March 13th. But the company, at least in late April, had declined to sign the CDC agreement for her to get off. Now crew are being told that they, U.S. citizens are being told they will be provided private transportation home starting this Wednesday.
And the crew are just as vulnerable as anyone else. Crew members have gotten sick. You wrote about recently about a Norwegian GEM cruise ship doctor who passed away from the virus. Tell us a little bit about Dr. Alex Guevara.
Yeah, so we actually don't know what exactly caused his death. The company's chief medical officer said in an email to employees that this doctor had been treating crew with respiratory illnesses on board the ship, but that he didn't have the virus. The company hasn't responded to multiple requests for comment about whether he was tested, if not why, if there's testing available on board. So the circumstances of his death are really murky at this point.
Now, as you pointed out a moment ago, that Royal Caribbean ultimately caved to the pressure and they went and signed off on the CDC guidelines for disembarking crew members. Do we know why they finally caved, why they were the first?
We don't know. And again, other companies, including Royal Caribbean, before this, Royal Caribbean had signed off on just one crew member's getting off. But other companies have signed off on very small amounts of crew to disembark. But it's not clear why. I mean, in statements from the CEOs yesterday to crew, the CEO of Royal Caribbean International, Michael Bailey, said, you know, basically in the spirit of doing everything possible, we're going to sign these agreements now.
And so the crew member we were just talking about, Julia, does that mean she gets to go home?
It should. I mean, that's what the company's saying at this point. Starting Wednesday, U.S. crew members stuck on cruise ships floating in around the U.S. Will be sent home on private transportation.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald's tourism reporter, Taylor Dolvin. You can find her reporting on the cruise ship industry during this pandemic. Just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. So let's switch gears here. The other story that was reported out last week, that the House has launched an investigation into Carnival Corporation's actions during this pandemic. Specifically, what are they looking for?
So they're looking mostly to figure out what Carnival Corporation knew and when they knew it. There were a lot of warnings, especially for Carnival, that saw its Diamond Princess cruise ship become the largest outbreak of COVID-19 cases outside China in mid-February. And the entire industry, including Carnival Corporation, continued to cruise up until March 13th. So the committee's really looking to find out why those decisions were made and what the company knew and when they knew it.
And the Diamond Princess, remind us again, because that became such a big story really fast.
Yeah, so there was an outbreak on the Diamond Princess cruise ship anchored in Japan in early February. The Japanese health ministry decided to quarantine the entire ship and keep everyone on board. Crew continued to work during that time, trying to take care of passengers, became infected themselves. More than 700 people from that ship became infected, and at least 8 have died.
So Carnival is not the only cruise line that's had issues, you know, during the pandemic. Why is the House targeting just them in this investigation?
No, and that's really important to note. No cruise company has been immune from outbreaks on its ships. All of the big four companies, Carnival Corporation, Royal Caribbean, Norwegian Cruise Line Holdings, and MSC Cruises have experienced crew and passenger infections. I think Carnival being the biggest company owning so much of the market share really gets a lot of attention for what it does. And but I think, you know, the committee could ask questions of other lines. We just don't know yet. But now it's really started with Carnival.
Have you heard from folks at Carnival about this upcoming investigation?
Yeah, they haven't actually responded to the committee yet. The committee sent the House Transportation Committee sent letters to Carnival, to the Coast Guard, to the CDC on Friday. And the committee said today it hasn't heard back from Carnival yet. But a spokesman told me, you know, we have the same goal as the committee, you know, finding out what happened, and they're planning on complying and participating fully.
So there are no cruises going on right now, but a number of companies have announced that they are booking cruises again beginning for August. Does this mean that cruise ships have been approved by the CDC to start setting up for cruises after summer?
So the CDC has said that all cruises are banned through July 24th or until the COVID-19 pandemic has been declared over. So companies continue to cancel cruises, most through mid-July. But Carnival Cruise Line this morning was the first to announce its plan to come back to cruising and said it will start cruising 8 of its ships out of Miami, Port Canaveral, and Galveston, Texas on August 1st.
What are you hearing from cruise line operators? I mean, are they optimistic that people are going to want to go back on a ship?
Yeah, they are. I mean, they're still seeing ticket sales for later in 2020, certainly next year and the following year. They none of them have announced any sort of new protocols for how they'll protect passengers and crew from COVID-19, but I suspect those will be coming soon. And they do remain optimistic, I would say.
Taylor Dolvin is the Miami Herald's tourism reporter. Again, you can check out all of her work on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Taylor, always a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
All right, still to come. Goodwill stores were not considered essential. They had to close their doors, and now they're asking for donations to help their workers. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Goodwill Industries of South Florida is a major employer in the region, with 7,000 workers normally receiving job training. But the economic shutdown caused by the pandemic has been devastating for the organization. They were forced to furlough thousands. The nonprofit depends on donations and sales at their retail locations, which have been closed since the middle of March. David Landsberg is the president and CEO of Goodwill Industries of South Florida, and he joins us now. David, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me, Luis.
Your organization, as I mentioned, employs thousands of people across South Florida. What were the thoughts that you had going through your head when the economic shutdown was just starting and you knew that you'd have to shut down because, again, you weren't considered essential?
Yeah, we were very, very concerned. We were staying very up to date with what was happening with the virus and casting new plans going forward. And we had kind of an impending sense that this was going to impact us greatly. And of course, the biggest concern is not just a business shutting down and people not having work, which is huge to begin with, but a social enterprise like Goodwill South Florida, where when you shut down, that means impacting people with disabilities and other barriers to work, the folks who need the work the very worst.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the interesting things about Goodwill is the approach to hiring. The company focuses on vulnerable communities to provide employment. So how are these folks getting by now when they don't have that steady paycheck? What's being done?
Well, they're getting by like other workers would in the community, hoping to be able to first get through and registered for unemployment and then receive checks. They're leaning on their families and doing whatever they can do to get through. And so really our outlook is get back into business and get back into opening back up jobs for people that have gone furloughed.
Did your organization try to make the case to Governor DeSantis that, you know, you should be considered an essential service so you could stay open or to reopen during this phase one?
Yeah, really, really interesting that you should ask, because your listeners may not know that Goodwill is not a nationwide charity structure-wise. So we're a local entity. We cover Dade, Broward, and Monroe. This Goodwill South Florida has a local board, local management, and it's governed locally. And so, like other organizations, we kind of just followed federal, state, and local guidelines. The Goodwill in Arizona did what you were saying and appealed to the governor that they're an essential business. and they actually got the governor to deem them an essential business. We thought about doing that, but quite frankly, it was as the virus was headed up towards its peak, and number one, we were pretty uncomfortable about the protection of our employees and customers in our stores, and quite frankly, once the local mayors declared it shelter in place, there really wasn't going to be a market for shoppers in our stores. And so once you hit a certain point, you can't have positive cash flow from a store. And if you don't, you're no longer helping fund the nonprofit. You're just making your problems worse. And so we really need to open as the consumer's ready to return. And that's what we're waiting for.
Were you seeing, before the pandemic was put in place, were you seeing a decline in shoppers already?
No, not at all. In fact, over the last couple of years where retail has really struggled, Goodwill stores have done incredibly well across the nation, up something like 4%. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. Of course, at the top of the list is really nice, affordable goods. But another thing on the list is that our younger generations are finding it very interesting to shop for unique items instead of being like everybody else. And then, of course, you've got, you know, the treasure hunters, the antique seekers, et cetera, that may be in a different socioeconomic level that are also Goodwill shoppers. So, you know, a real strange stat for us is we run 36 stores in Dade and Broward, and at the top of our list on productivity of stores, we have one in the very most trying zip code in the county, and one in one of the best zip codes. So what it tells you is, regardless of the reason, many, many people like to shop at Goodwill, enough that it could actually make a store in a great area one of your top stores, and a store in one of the toughest areas a great store as well.
Has the pandemic forced the organization to shift from, you know, its brick-and-mortar stores, you know, selling clothes and household supplies and so forth, to other sorts of operations?
Well, it has, and we had long begun putting items on the web for sale. There is a site called shopgoodwill.com. In fact, I encourage people that are at home to take a look. What ends up happening is we take really good stuff from each one of the 36 stores. We photograph it, we verify what it is, and we put it up on the web for sale. And shopgoodwill.com and Amazon, where we put our books, can now account for about 8% of our sales. And so, thankfully, during the shelter-in-place thing, we at least had an option here of putting goods on the web for sale. In fact, we put many more goods for sale on the web because we didn't have the opportunity in a storefront.
It helps a little bit, but still a lot of people had to be furloughed. It's still
a huge problem. And I didn't even mention that about 4 days past shutting the stores, we made the decision to shut our manufacturing plant here in Alapata. And so I'm sure a lot of your listeners say, well, what do you mean, Goodwill manufacturing plant? And so what we do to raise funds is not the mission of the organization. So the mission of the organization is all about vocational training, placement, and employment for people with disabilities and other barriers to work. And so we'll pretty much do anything that can move along that mission. So over the years, in addition to the stores, in addition to the main way that people know us, we operate in four other industries. And those do two things. This is a really interesting model. They help fund the nonprofit because we want them all to cash flow. But more importantly, they provide jobs for people who are in a spot where they cannot get a job as easy as you or I. They are challenged by their disability. They're challenged by their lack of work sometimes and just other disadvantages. And so what we are able to do is not only vocationally train them and declare success, we are actually able to employ them in these industries. And so the other ones are this apparel manufacturing plant that we have. We run a very large custodial cleaning business, and I'm pretty sure your listeners don't know that we clean almost every federal, state, and local building in all of South Florida, 130 buildings, about 6 million square feet. And mostly at night, Goodwill workers are in cleaning government buildings. And one of the more recent enterprises we started was a commercial laundry. And the Goodwill commercial laundry now does sheets, blankets, towels for every major hospital in South Florida, in Miami in particular. And lastly, just this year, we're starting up a third-party logistics business, which has to do with helping the Army do more of what it can do efficiently. So back to the apparel plant. About 4 days past shutting the stores, we got a positive test result, corona result in our plant, and we got very concerned about that because this building has a lot of workers, and as the thing was on the rise, it seemed like a very wise thing to just stop producing for a while. So even though that plant, what we do is so military uniform, so it is an essential business, we made the decision to shut it about 5 weeks ago. And that impacted another 1,200 people. So that's 1,200 from the stores, 1,200 from the sewing plant, and about another office people. So the total number of people furloughed, 2,500, which is devastating, especially 2,500 out of 3,100.
Yeah.
So all of these enterprises together make us really one of the largest social enterprises in the country, where we now have, under normal times, 3,100 people working for us, 17th largest employer in all of South Florida. But the people who are working for us overwhelmingly need that job, need that first job, need that first experience. And then once success is achieved, they end up self-selecting out of here and are able to go on that interview, have a work history behind them, and go with more confidence than they had before.
Again, talking with David Landsberg, President and CEO of Goodwill South Florida, the organization, again, having to lay off and furlough many of its employees because of this pandemic. And because we have to adapt to this new world right now of social distancing. David, have you been able to take donations like you used to do for the stores, or has that also stopped?
No, that actually, well, I'm going to say yes and no. So, you know, many, many people give donations at the store. And so since we shut the 36 stores, those locations were closed. But in Dade, in particular, we have part of our 55 attended donation trailers. So that's where you see what looks like, you know, the backside of a truck, one of our Goodwill people working in there, and it's a real easy drive-up experience. We have some of those in Broward as well, and we have a couple small dedicated donation stores. And so those 55 locations have stayed open throughout. And so I'd just like to thank South Florida and your listeners for continuing to donate to Goodwill. It wasn't a risk because we really only have one person working in there. And actually, I've often witnessed the donor dropping the bag at the stairs and then our worker coming down and getting it. So it's a very safe exchange. That has gone very well. We've actually, since the stores are not open, we have a great stockpile to get us going once the stores do open.
And that's an interesting point. So you're building up this stockpile. How long can Goodwill continue like this, you know, before it becomes really problematic in being able to reopen those stores?
Yeah, it's problematic right now. So just to give you a sense of what this has done financially, and, you know, we operate day to day without a large reserve. And we do that so we can put as much as we can into providing job opportunities for people with these disabilities. And we're very focused on growth, and that takes working capital. And so we never have a lavish reserve to sit on, and that showed itself more clearly in this event than anything. And so there is all kinds of buildings we've got and overhead that we have to endure whether we're open or not. And so this virus has about a $3 million a month burn rate. And so what that means is that Goodwill South Florida, given enough time in this ugly situation, will be without cash and will be fully extended on bank line.
And is there going to be a conversation, whether it's with the governor or with local leaders? So the state is reopened, but South Florida can't.
Correct.
Not yet. But when they finally get to that point, you know, for their phase one of reopening, is there going to be a push to say, you know what, we want to be part of that, and here's how we could do it and keep everybody safe? Is that possible, or what do you think?
I think it is possible. You know, we're hopeful that the coming couple of weeks will bring some light on the idea of the rest of the businesses opening. We have been able to bring some people back into our sewing plant, first to sew PPE, actually. So we had Baptist coming to us in a little bit of a panic over masks and isolation gowns. And so we have been able to fabricate those on the fly. We never made those items before. But in the course of a week or so, we were able to figure out how to do that. And we've supplied Baptist with about 5,000 masks and about 12,000 isolation gowns. And we are bringing some smaller work groups back in to work on some parts of the military uniform. So that is going well. We certainly don't want to completely fill the plant because we want to stay safe. And so what we're doing is everybody gets their temperature taken at the front door. Nobody enters without a mask. Everybody gets hand sanitizer, and everybody's workstation is now further apart than it was before, including a vinyl divider on the front part of the workstation. So we've taken a lot of measures to make sure we can be safe, and fortunately, we've been able to just little by little open up the manufacturing plant. But the stores themselves are causing quite an issue. So if we see this going on for many more weeks, I think we will appeal. Just to give you an idea, by geography, there are 8 other Goodwills in the state of Florida that are now open. And here we are in Dayton Broward, the only one who won't be open this week. And so we'll just watch and wait, but we will appeal that pretty soon if it goes much, much longer.
David Landsberg, he is the president and CEO of Goodwill South Florida. David, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, still to come, will more people get into gardening because of the pandemic? Maybe you are. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, in 1919, Americans were encouraged to start gardens, to grow food in helping the war efforts. Almost 40% of our food was produced by what were called victory gardens. During difficult times, I'm wondering, do we have this innate need to garden? There's been a rise in the sale of seeds, and now there's wait times in some cases if you want to get some certain types of seeds. In Miami, we reached out to folks at Midtown Garden Center who said there's been an uptick in people buying seeds and potting soil. Have you recently picked up gardening? Tell us about what inspired you. Maybe you have a garden and you have some advice for the rest of us who do not have green thumbs. Give us a call, 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can always find us on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. And let us know, you know, again, if you are getting into gardening because of this pandemic, maybe it's inspired you. We'd like to hear your thoughts and any questions you may have. Joining me now is Adrian Huntsberger, former urban horticulture agent and entomologist at the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. Adrian, great to have you.
Thank you very much.
You know, when the pandemic was announced and you saw people rushing to the stores and certain supplies were selling out very quickly, what did you think might happen to our food supply? Was ever a concern?
I don't think, you never know, but it seems that our food supply seems to be fine. There's plentiful food, especially now. But yes, getting to the topic of vegetable gardening, we can talk about that.
You know, it's a unique situation because we haven't been in a pandemic like this in basically a century, but we've been through wars, other, you know, viruses, economic collapses. How do those impact our food supply? Is there ever a concern, or is our system built so that it can handle any of this?
At least since the Vietnam War, I think our United States food supply has always been in terrific shape. But I think a lot of people, you know, you never know, and sometimes we get a little bit nervous, and whether the worst happens or not is, you know, time will tell, but it seems like, at least for the current situation, the food supply is going to be available.
I recall, and I don't know, Adrian, you tell me if you saw this as well, but when we had the big recession over a decade ago, people started talking a lot about gardening.
Yeah.
And people were talking about how, you know what, I want to become self-sufficient. I want to be able to take care of myself. And so there was all of a sudden this interest in gardening. Did you see that as well?
Especially after First Lady Michelle Obama was really promoting gardening for your own food supply. And it might not be that we're feeding, you know, taking care of all our food needs by growing our own food, but to supplement. And I think also just learning the joy of gardening and seeing how nature works.
Now, I mentioned at the beginning, and some people have thrown this idea around, this idea of victory garden. But again, that was a term that was used during World War One. It was a term for war. You don't like that term, victory garden, in this situation, right?
Well, you know, originally, yeah, victory gardens were also popular during World War Two, and they were also called war gardens. But, you know, it's a term that now is kind of loosely used and means different things to different people. So we've been trying to encourage edible gardeners. So in South Florida, we're so lucky in that, you know, we can grow all sorts of different things year-round. And, you know, thinking of our landscape as our edible garden.
Yeah. And again, that's what we're talking about right now. We're talking about gardening. Has there been a pickup in gardening? More people want to get into gardening because of this pandemic. Maybe you've had a garden for a while, and you may have some good advice for the rest of us. Call in 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Again, share with us if you've had a garden for a while. You know, maybe share with us what's the best thing to grow down here in South Florida. Maybe you're starting a garden. What's the question you want to ask about how to? We heard from some folks already. Jennifer Oliver Smith sent us this message.
This is Jennifer Smith in Lake Worth. About a month and a half ago, we started a garden just using kitchen scraps like the tops of carrots, the base of a celery, onion, garlic. We sprouted everything in water, and after finding a used garden bed, we were able to plant it. And every day, my four-year-old daughter and I check the progress of our garden. It's been slow going, but so has lockdown. So it's something to look forward to every morning, walk outside, hear the birds, go in the sunshine, and see how our garden is growing.
Jennifer also told us that it's, quote, it's been a slow process, but it's very satisfying. Each day she goes out with her four-year-old daughter to check out their garden's progress. And she also said that my little one and I love the ritual of watering our plants each morning and seeing how they've grown. So, and again, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Share with us, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. And, you know, let us know, again, your questions or your thoughts about gardening. Have you gotten into gardening because of this pandemic? Adrian, in the time that you've been at UF, and by the way to mention, I think you just retired, right?
Yeah, last Friday was my first day of retirement.
Well, congratulations. And you know, we'll talk about the second part of your life here in a little bit. But in all the time that you spent, what have the attitudes towards gardening been and how they changed over the years?
Well, I started as an extension agent 21 years ago, and nobody was interested in vegetable gardening. The economy was strong, you know, and then we went to, you know, the 2000s, and, you know, there was slowly more and more interest in growing food. And then, as I said, during the Great Recession, people got very inspired and very interested. So it's interesting to see, and really it hasn't really slowed down since then. I think once people became successful and really learned the joys, they kept at it.
What is unique about gardening in South Florida? Because of our weather, our climate, you know, what are the challenges?
That's a phenomenal question. I was hoping you'd get to it. So, contrary to what the seed packets say, and contrary to what the little seedlings you can get at the garden center say about when to plant, we're the complete opposite. So we actually start our vegetable gardening season in October, and we've pretty much wrapped up all the traditional vegetables by now. So now is the perfect time to start putting in summer vegetables, and those are more the tropicals. So, yeah, things are different because if you picked up a gardening magazine or a book or the seed packet, it's all the wrong information as far as when to plant.
Yeah, because our summers, you know, we just ended the harvest season for a lot of foods, and our summers get really, really hot. But what are some of those summer vegetables we can grow?
Well, you can grow sweet potatoes, you can grow collards, black-eyed peas, and I was going to mention, too, that with some of these, you can go to your grocery store to get the plant parts to start your garden. So, like with black-eyed peas and some of the other beans, like pigeon peas, if you're just shopping and you're buying a bag of dried beans, just hold on to a few of those seeds because they are seeds, and as long as they're, you know, not really old, you can plant with them. You can grow ginger, hot peppers, okra, Cuban pumpkin, which is called calabaza, maybe even some eggplants. So there's quite a few things that you can be planting now.
Yeah. And you know what? I have to ask, too, because, you know, and when we get some of these, go to the phones here in just a moment, not just folks who've already been growing their gardens, but those of us who don't have green thumbs, or we think we don't have green thumbs. But, you know, when somebody says, I want to start a garden, you know, usually what's the advice you give on how they should get started?
Okay. Well, we've developed a lot of online resources people who don't have access to the internet usually will call us at the extension office. So every county has an extension office and their wealth of information. On the Miami-Dade County Extension website, we actually put up some YouTube videos on starting your garden, how to plant seeds, how to care for your garden. We've written some very easy to understand how to build a raised bed garden because we, contrary to what farmers have to do, people will be much more successful if they grow in a raised bed garden. And there's some tricks specific to South Florida. So we talk about some of the things that need attention. And we have fact sheets on what to plant when and the 12 easiest vegetables to grow. So we have a lot of resources readily available.
Again, talking with Adrian Huntsberger, former urban horticulture agent and entomologist at UF. And again, talking about gardening. Are more people getting into gardening? We've seen that seeds and soil are selling out in some places. So are more people getting into gardening now? Because, well, we're staying at home. We have the time, right? Share with us if you've had a garden for a while. Maybe you have some advice for us. Or if you're starting one, what question do you have? 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Let's go to Vanya in Coconut Grove. Vanya, thanks for calling in today.
Hi, my pleasure. Thanks for taking my call. My question was about gardening indoors. The apartment where I live has windows and doors only on one side of the building that faced east. The other side is completely walled off. And we've got a lot of restrictions on how tall and how many plants we can put out on the balcony. So my question is, are there tips that we can consider for growing plants close to the windows or close to the sliding glass doors that maybe could maintain a certain height so they're not seen? So we just kind of want ideas on what are the best things we can grow that we can kind of keep hidden.
This is a great question, and one I had as well. If you have an apartment, you're limited. So, yeah, I mean, Adrian, for Vanya, limited space. What would you suggest?
Well, it depends on the light exposure. So, if there's a balcony and you're allowed to have some plants outside, if it's south facing, that's the best for the fruiting types of vegetables. But again, remember, we're going into the tropical season, so it's going to be a little bit more of a challenge. You won't be able to grow sweet potato, but you could grow hot peppers, you could grow okra, black-eyed peas, collards. And then if you don't get full sun all day long, you're going to be more and more challenged. So maybe thinking of some herbs. So, yeah, you're talking about doing something on the windowsill. That would be great to grow herbs.
All
right.
And the pepper plants and okras, can those be brought indoors if they're near a glass window?
It's going to be really, really tough. So these plants need at least 6 to 8 hours of direct sun. So some people will actually get grow lights. So you could try that and see if you can get enough light on those plants for them to produce fruit for you.
Yeah. Vanya, I've heard that too. Herbs might be the easier way to go. I might be forced to just only grow that myself, but give it a shot. See what happens, and hopefully it works out for you. Thanks so much for the call. Appreciate it. Let me go now to, I want to go to Karen in Miami Beach, talking about herbs. Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I had a couple of comments and a question.
Sure.
So I've medium experience grower, and I've lived in both apartments and in houses. And for houses, I would recommend if you have potted plants, or even if you have enough space, try the same variety in multiple areas with different levels of, say, draining or sunlight. Because you're more, maybe one the plant will love and another one they won't love nearly as much.
Yeah.
And for apartments, if you like fresh herbs, it, you usually get a lot more yield out of your effort.
I see. Yeah. All right. And what's your question?
Okay. So actually, I had a bigger question. Is it really that sustainable to grow your own vegetables? Like, we're under the impression that's better for the environment, but the packaging is smaller. Who knows where the earth is coming from? So is it actually as sustainable, or are we just kind of doing it because we like it?
Okay, that's a very good question. Karen, thanks so much for bringing that up. Adrian, this idea of sustainability is what we're all struggling to get to. Growing our own gardens seems like it would be, right?
Right. Yeah, so you're not going to be using topsoil or earth. You're going to be using compost and potting soil. So that's pretty easy to really figure out what that is. Either it can be peat base or core, which comes from coconuts. It's sometimes putting out the notion that you're going to be we do things differently here for a lot of different reasons. Now, economically sustainability, because that's another word. It's like, okay, well, what do we mean by sustainability? So if it's economics, it might be cheaper buying your own fresh food. I did a study a few years ago looking at home gardens, and herbs and tomatoes, you will reap far more economically than if you went to the store and bought them. So kind of, you know, it all depends on what you're interested in.
Yeah. Very good point, Karen. Thank you for bringing that up. Let's take one more caller here. Quickly, I'm going to go to Kara in Deerfield Beach. Kara, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks so much.
Go ahead, Kara.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that I've been enjoying growing a tower garden in my backyard. I live in Deerfield Beach, and it's really easy. It's a lot of fun, especially for families, and it's awesome to see your produce grow from seeds in the tower garden in my backyard.
So and real quickly, for people, so Kara, for people who don't know, tell us what a tower garden is.
Well, it's a hydroponic garden. You start with rock wool, and you put in seeds, and then as the seeds grow into little plants, then you put them into this tower garden, and internally the water goes up and down, and within a couple of weeks you've got romaine lettuce, I have chives, I have tomatoes, I have cucumbers that are all growing out of a tower, and basically with water and the nutrients that you put in every couple of weeks, so you don't have to do any planting at all.
Yeah.
And it's all organic and very easy.
That sounds fantastic. Kara, thank you so much. That sounds really fun. But Adrian, what about that? What about tower gardening?
Yeah, it's a form of also vertical gardening where, you know, you're using, especially for people who have a patio or have a balcony, is using your walls to hold your plants. So it's a very efficient use of space if you don't have much space. You can also grow hydroponically using a children's plastic kiddie pool. University of Florida, if you just Google, you know, just put in University of Florida hydroponic gardening. They actually show you how to build one with wooden sides, and they tell you how to make that type of hydroponic garden where you don't even need to have a pump to circulate the water. So there's many, many different ways to skin a cat.
I tell you what, I've got a couple of good pointers. I've taken notes myself, so I'm going to see which ones I can get started. Again, Adrian Huntsberger, former urban horticulture agent, entomologist at the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. Adrian, thanks so much and enjoy your retirement.
Thank you very much.
We got to get you back. We'll talk more gardening soon.
Okay, thank you.
So now we're going to end the program on a little bit of a down note. Miami Dolphins great coach Don Shula, who coached the team from 1970 to 1995, died this morning at his home. He was 90. Shula is still the winningest coach in the NFL. He led the Dolphins to 5 Super Bowls, and they won 2, and they had the 1972 perfect season. Well, some years back, the Miami Herald's Greg Cody spoke with Shula about his illustrious career and that perfect season.
Don, this, I don't know if it's occurred to you yet, but this coming season is the 20th year since you stopped coaching.
That's unbelievable. What do you think about that? 20 years that I've been out of coaching.
Yeah.
It seems like only yesterday that people were yelling at me and getting mad and saying, why'd he do this and why'd he do that?
Right. You told me once that the thing you missed most was the Sunday afternoon, those 3 hours when you were on the sideline and everything was happening.
It's something you could never predict, you could never replicate. It just... you know, you just got to make it happen when you're presented with a situation. And you practice and you gear up all week long for all the things that can happen. Then you find out you didn't do enough. There's more that happened that you thought would happen.
Right.
And it's just a fascinating game. It's a game of making quick decisions and making the decisions that you make them the right decisions, make them work.
Mm-hmm.
That's what coaching's all about.
You're the only coach in all of professional sports who's associated with the word perfection.
I like that. I like that association.
What
that sounds good.
Yeah. What does that mean to you, just being, having that singular distinction after all these years?
Well, because of the fact that you're the only one and we were the only team, it just makes it that much more important. It gives you that much more pride in the accomplishment.
Again, that was the Miami Herald's Greg Cody talking with the late, great Don Shula. That was about 5 years ago now. What will you remember about Coach Shula? Well, we heard from some of you. Scotty Shapiro from Coral Springs says he went to his first game. It was in the mid-80s. By then, Dan Marino was a superhero. Coach Shula was more important than the president. This is what he said.
Growing up, I didn't even know anyone else was allowed to coach the Dolphins. You won the most games, and you won the best. You were the perfect head coach for South Florida, and you'll never be replaced. Rest in peace, Coach Shula.
We also heard from Garth Rose on Twitter. Rest in peace, Don. You did so much for football in South Florida. No other coach like you for the Miami Dolphins. Great job accomplished. Brandon Almeida commented on Instagram, a professional through and through, always lent a hand to other football programs in the city, will be missed. Absolutely. And I could say, I got into the business. I was a sports reporter when I first started. It was after he had already left, but I did get one time the opportunity to interview Coach Shula. It's when he opened up his Shula restaurant, and I met him in a hotel. We did a 20-minute interview, and I got to say, he was a classy guy, really nice. Treated me, this young, silly reporter who still had so much to learn, treated me like a professional, and I'll always remember him. But I'll just say it as a fan, a longtime fan. Thanks, Coach. Really appreciated everything you did. Hope you rest in peace. Hope your family finds peace, and you will be missed. Well, that's our program for this Monday, May 4th. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, Miami-Dade County Superintendent Alberto Carvalho leading one of the biggest school districts during this pandemic. He's going to join us. Take a lot of questions. If you have questions, find us on social media, and we will ask him tomorrow. He's joining us on the program. Plus, we're going to explore the world of homeschooling. I mean, a lot of parents have to experience this now as the remote learning has continued. We're going to learn from parents that have been homeschooling for a while. Maybe they have some advice for you. And by the way, today at 3 p.m. on WLRN's Facebook, education reporter Jessica Bateman is going to be interviewing a West Palm science teacher about how online learning is going so far. This is part of a new virtual conversation that we're doing during the coronavirus. It's called WLRN Connects. Again, go to WLRN's Facebook at 3 p.m. today. As always, I thank you so much for listening. You can find us at WLRN.org. Listen to any of our old programs. You can find us on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. And if you can't listen live or at 8 p.m. for the rebroadcast, why not find us on our podcast? Find the podcast on iTunes and listen anytime. We always love to hear from you, by the way. Let us know what you think of the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Remember, stay safe. I know that we're trying to get out there more. Stay safe. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.